The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? It's a question evolutionists often laugh at, and the reason they laugh is because they don't have any answers one way or the other. Utter interdependability. This is something that utterly defeats the evolutionary theory and some of the strange admissions made by the father, or you might call him the messiah, of all evolutionary thought, Charles Darwin, are going to be given to you on this program. Now, in a series of broadcasts that I've called Seven Proofs God Exists, we have covered one after the other of the great proofs that there is a God and scientific proofs. Proofs that are logical, that appeal to a logical, modern, informed, and educated mind. I'm not talking about some wild, emotional idea. I've already shown you on a series of broadcasts how it was that many an evolutionist has admitted that his belief in evolution is a great faith, an almost unbelievable faith, and absolutely no proof. And how evolutionists have admitted they have clung to their theories in spite of all of the amassed factual information that has been collected through careful weight and measurement, experimentation, and observation to the contrary. Now, most of you think it's the other way around. You really do. The average individual feels a little bit, well, sort of overwhelmed and bamboozled, I think, by science. He feels that science certainly has all the answers, and that anybody today who believes in God, in this space age technology of ours, this modern dog-eat-dog competitive world, is certainly out of date. He thinks, it isn't that he's proved it, he has no evidence to prove this, but he thinks that the Bible is a collection of ancient Judaic or Hebrew literature. He thinks it's a bunch of outdated poetry, that it's the attempt of one little tiny race of people to aggrandize themselves in their own national history. He thinks the Bible is poetry and songs. It's for hymn singers and Bible thumpers and doomsday prophets. But he doesn't think that the Bible presents any proofs that there is a great God and that he is working out a real purpose here below. And even the clergy gets in on that one. I've quoted recently on the World Tomorrow program, on radio around the world, about how many leading members of the clergy have told people, well, the Bible doesn't try to prove there is a God. Oh, yes, it does, my friends. When a book says, prove me now herewith, when the book says that you can look at that which is the material creation, that you can know, in the words of the Apostle Paul in the first chapter of Romans, that by looking at the material physical creation, you can know about the invisible things of God, then that book is saying you can prove there is a God. And that's a fact. And it's about time you discovered it's a fact for yourself. Now, every single month in the Plain Truth magazine, we've been running articles on the subject of evolution. And we've been showing the readers of the Plain Truth, now numbering perhaps, well, we think there's no definite way to estimate it, but perhaps somewhere between 3 and 4 million people around the world. About 1 million copies now being sent out every single month, absolutely free of charge, on 3 continents and sent around the world, 52 pages, full color throughout. And in these highly informative, colorful, and interesting articles, where we've had scoop pictures that have outdone some of the real top scientific journals on such strange creatures as the little archer fish, and anapleps, a little fish with 4 eyes, and others, we have come to an article about the ant. And the little ant that is so common, and such a pesky little insect to all of us, that could be right there where you're sitting at this moment if you're not careful. Or the chances are, if you were to go into your kitchen, you might find the little critters busily carrying off all of the contents of your sugar bowl. And whether you live in Boston or Bloemfontein, or whether you live in Africa or in the United States, you are familiar with a number of kinds of ants. What you may not realize is that ants, evinced from the very Messiah, or you might call him the father of the evolutionary world, Charles Darwin, some of the most absolutely embarrassing and, you might say, damaging admissions to the evolutionary theory that you will ever have heard. And in the Plain Truth magazine, in the article entitled, Go to the Ant, you're going to see those admissions with your own eyes. Now, I ask, which came first, the chicken or the egg? And I ask that for a specific purpose. Because evolutionists admit, and Charles Darwin admitted, that if you can find in nature any kind of creature, any kind of species of life, which exists for any other purpose than to propagate or to perpetuate its own survival. That is, if you can find any creature which seems to exist for the sole purpose of serving or helping or in some way aiding another kind of life form, but to its own destruction, to its own lack of survival, then this would certainly throw right out the window and utterly defeat the entire idea of evolution. Well, you're going to hear exactly how that is true. Now, it's true in many areas, as I'm going to show you, not just in the case of the ant. Well, the ant is our commonest insect. A lot of people buy their kiddies a little ant farm because the children like to watch these little busy creatures tunneling and digging away. And, of course, woe be unto the little boy that tips his ant farm over and then the housewife finds them in the bed. But you're familiar maybe with one or two kinds of ants. You may not realize that there are many, many thousands of species of ants in the world and that ants do a lot of fantastic things. There are 3,500 different species of them in the world. Some of them are the size of a giant bumblebee with a long stinger in their tail. Others are almost all head and powerful mandibles or jaws and little thorax or tiny little body. Some so tiny they're barely visible to the human eye. But did you know that ants can predetermine the sex and the number of their offspring? Did you know that in some ant species, the queen resembles a sort of a sausage with a head tacked on, and that she is able to predetermine the sex? And in many cases, that sex is neuter, or in other words, a sterile female, and to predetermine the size and the shape and the number of the other ants that make up an ant colony. Now, ants do a lot more than that. Did you know that ants have a unique protection racket, that they hire themselves out as mercenary soldiers? Did you know that some of them come up with their own expert battle maneuvers? And that some of them are living storage vessels, that they even herd a kind of an ant cattle, and that they have enslaved, captured soldiers of other ant colonies. Did you know they milk their ant cows, aphids, as I'll talk about later, by a strange process that even Charles Darwin tried to imitate and failed? Did you know that ants store honey, that ants harvest crops, that they make their own corks, that they harvest and store seeds? And some ants even sew leaves together, and all that without the benefit of needle and thread. And the army ants march in a regular cyclical rhythm, marching, resting, eating, and then marching, resting, and eating, on a 17-day cycle. There's more to learn about ants than practically any other insect, and the reason for that, of course, is because they're so common, and they're so everyday. They're around us in our sandwiches and picnic baskets. But all those busy little ants struggling to carry away your sugar cube by cube are very likely the progeny of just one queen. Now, here's where it gets to be a real problem for evolution. The queen of an ant colony is a sort of a fantastic life-producing cylinder, you might call her. After the mating dance, which takes place high in the air, she comes back down to the colony, and then she molts her wings and actually even lives off of the decaying wings that she uses to sort of eat up that with her body fat, and begins to produce soldiers. Now, soldiers in an ant colony are the organizers, defenders, and military strategists of the nest, and they look like they're all head and pincers with a tiny body and legs. But the thing is, ant soldiers are infertile females, a sort of a neuter gender, and their sole responsibility is to care for the larvae. You'll see them as a child you have, maybe as an adult, if you've gotten down on your hands and knees and watched a group of ants carrying these little white larvae or eggs back and forth. Now, this queen is able to produce many different types of soldiers for the colony, including giants and super soldiers, pygmy soldiers, specialized workers, and the like. Some of these workers exist for one specific reason. For example, you may not have known that there is a type of ant in the colony who is the butcher. And he is so designed, it's a neuter female again that is unable to reproduce, but this butcher is designed with these powerful jaws for the express purpose of tearing up live flesh from living prey. Others are born or produced and designed for the express purpose of being tiny janitors, and that's all they do in life. Now, one evolutionist was so amazed when he looked at ants and found out what they're like that he could only comment about this. He called it assembly line reproduction. And he said, and I quote, that these widely different forms can come from the same mother is remarkable, but that the male is also their own flesh and blood is more remarkable still, because he went on to say, the male in appearance is not an ant at all, but a hornet, 2 inches long with magnificent eyes, or wings rather, and a splendid array of eyes. But now you see, here's the rub, here's the problem for evolution. Evolution must always see consequence in nature. They've got to see some consequence, some way in which all these creatures can fit into their idea of the struggle for survival, of the struggle for the survival of the fittest, of adaptation, of ecological change and the like. In some way, they have to see another life form, or this specific life form, being served in the life cycles of every creature. They like to see some kind of consequence in it. But in the ant, they can see only inconsequence. They can't see any consequence in this. It stands to reason that the queen would reproduce another fertile species, which would then change into a slightly different fertile species, which would change into another, and so on and on and on. But the facts are that a queen can produce by predetermining the size and the exact job for life and the shape and the sex. She can produce certain numbers of fertile, and that's not predetermined, apparently, or set up as automatic. They don't know exactly how it works. They just don't have any answer for it one way or the other. It's a fantastic story, but it's about time you looked into it and saw some of the admissions that were made by the very father of the evolutionary theory, Charles Darwin himself. Now, to go on with one quotation that you've just got to hear, because this is like a lot of them I've read in the World Tomorrow program, it's amazing. The average layman never hears these things, and the average student who is in a university seeking a degree in the field of biology or chemistry or science, or if he wants to become a geologist to go to work for an oil company and he's studying, he swallows evolution. He swallows it hook, line, and sinker. He thinks that these men are great pedants. He thinks they're great scholars. He thinks they know exactly what they're talking about, and the admissions that they make seem to escape him somehow. Well, it's about time you heard some of the admissions and saw them with your own eyes. Now, here's one that you just got to listen to. The females, said this one evolutionist, John Crompton, are not only blind, but they've lost all traces of eyes, where eyes, presumably, and you might insert a question mark there, once were, is now smooth and solid skull. It must have taken a long time, he theorized, for this reverse order, or this reverse development to take place. And yet the female still breeds males with eyes. Now look at the problems here for evolution. Surpassing, that is in their ability to see, the development of these eyes, surpassing those of most other insects. Then this evolutionist concludes, and I quote his words, here his quotes, evolution plays strange tricks. End of quote. Oh, you bet it does. I agree to that. Evolution is very tricky. You got to watch evolution. You got to watch evolutionists very closely because they admit that evolution plays strange tricks. Well, these ants don't play any strange tricks one way or the other. They're utterly dependable. You can predict exactly what they're going to do. You can predict exactly what this queen is going to do. You can predict exactly the kind and size of a colony and the number of fertile and infertile and all the rest of that. But this man admits evolution plays strange tricks. Yes, we'll agree to that. They certainly do. But now, to a few quotations from Charles Darwin in his rather thick and pedantic volume, the one with which most people are most familiar, that is called Origin of Species. This is certainly one of the most familiar volumes that Charles Darwin ever wrote. It's a virtual Bible, you might call it, of the evolutionary world. Now, he couldn't explain the problem of these neuters in the lowly ant. He just could not explain it. Here's what he said. I will confine myself, quoting from Charles Darwin, to one special difficulty which at first appeared insuperable, that is, absolutely insurmountable, they couldn't answer it, and actually fatal to the whole theory. Those are his words, not mine. He went on, and I continue quoting. I allude to the neuters, or sterile females, in insect communities. For these neuters often differ widely in instinct and structure from both the males and fertile females, and yet, from being sterile, they cannot propagate their kind. I went on to say, the subject deserves to be discussed at great length. But I will here take only a single case, and so it never got discussed at great length. I said the subject deserves to be discussed at great length, but I will here take only a single case, that of working or sterile ants. How the workers have been rendered sterile is a difficulty, he said. But, and I'm again quoting Charles Darwin's words after he admitted it's a difficulty, he said. I want to quote these words slowly, and I want you to listen to this because the average person has just never heard it before. But I must pass over this preliminary difficulty. End of quotation. He said, I must pass over this preliminary difficulty. That's like a lot of admissions I've seen in evolutionary books. That's why I'm on the World Tomorrow program with a series of broadcasts called Seven Proofs God Exists, because the average layman will just about parrot the words he's heard from some biologist or anthropologist or somebody else, like as not a philosophy professor, who says there isn't any God and you can't prove it. There is no way to prove it. There's no use looking. The proofs aren't available. I say, oh, yes, there are proofs, and plenty of them, and those proofs are available. Like the young man that wandered into a large public library, and he asked the librarian, he was a frustrated college student, and he said, I would like to find a book that proves that God exists. And then when he couldn't find the book, he wrote to a newspaper, and he said, I did this, I went to the library, I asked the librarian, she told me there wasn't any such book. The newspaper promptly wrote back to him, and he said, well, it's a pity that there isn't such a book, but there isn't any. Well, my friends, there is. There is such a book. Now, that book is the Bible, and you can find places in the Bible that tell you exactly how to go about proving there is a God. Look, when the Bible says right inside of its own pages, prove me now herewith, and claims to be in first person the very one who identifies himself in the Bible as God, God Almighty, the Creator God, and he says, you prove, then certainly he must have given you some method by which you may prove his existence. So these seven proofs that I've been going through on the World Tomorrow are, first of all, the proof of law. As I've shown continually, the very fact of law, the laws of physics, of chemistry, the laws of science, the workable laws, the living laws, the active laws, the utterly dependable laws upon which your very life depends, those demand a lawgiver. They demand it. There isn't any other answer. You can't do anything about it. You can defy them. You can temporarily try to get around these laws, but you cannot suspend them. You can't break them. They're going to break you if you try. The second is the very existence of the material creation in the first place. The fact of the existence of energy, of matter, or you can call it creation, demands a creator. And then another one, a major proof, life, the existence of life, the fact that with all of their claims about amino acids and DNA and all the rest of it, but you need to be very careful about those quotations and see all the perhapses and the possibles and the maybes in the theory, that life comes into existence only from pre-existing life. And that brings us to an overlapping proof, which is the fourth major proof of kind after kind, the fact of interdependability of the sustainer of this universe, who keeps everything going, that we know it's an absolute law of biogenesis, that life produces life, and not only that, but pre-existing life of the same kind. My friends, there are proofs available, and evolution stands utterly and absolutely disproved, and I can prove that to you. If you want to write for these booklets I announce continually, Does God Exist? And the one on the proof of the Bible that takes Bible prophecy, the prophecies that have been fulfilled and that are being fulfilled, and goes right down the line with them one after another. I want to go back and quote Charles Darwin again. I'm talking about this one factor. It's a broad factor. It's a huge factor, and that is the utter interacting interdependability of all life forms. Now, evolutionists admit that if you can find any one little creature that exists seemingly for the sole purpose of aiding and abetting and helping other creatures instead of helping himself to survive, that would be virtually fatal to the evolutionary theory. Well, not only one, but many such instances exist. To what would you liken a lichen? What's a lichen like? On a World Tomorrow program on radio, I was talking about lichens, and I was talking about how there is an interacting or a sort of a partnership here between plant and animal, that the one sort of gives out a secretion which breaks down rock, which is fed upon by the other, which in turn gives out a secretion which is fed upon by the first. The one cannot live without the other. But which came first? Now, you can look at this in a broad sense wherever you are, whether it's the web of food, the food chain in the sea, or what you might call the web of life on the earth that exists in the soil. Take a look at the relationship between man and plants, and the plants and the animals. Now look, it's real simple. You don't need to be a scientist to understand some of these things. You've got to live by taking oxygen into your lungs. And when you do so, you're breathing that which is produced by little green plants. The process of what is called, to make it sound technical, photosynthesis. The process by which growing green things produce your oxygen. Now on the other hand, those growing green things have to convert carbon dioxide that they take out of the air as the major gas of the air. Where does all of that come from? It is supplied by man and by animals, by all the breathing human beings and the animals on the earth that are gradually and constantly taking oxygen out of the air and putting carbon dioxide, overloading it, back into the air. And so here exists an interdependent life cycle. The one depends upon the other. This is only a part of it. There are vast areas. I couldn't cover it in 100 programs. But continually in the pages of the Plain Truth magazine or articles along this line, you can have them. And they're up to the moment. They're absolutely scientific. They're prepared in our Ambassador College science lab. Some of the most remarkable photos you'll ever lay eyes upon. And it does disprove evolution. Now back to this embarrassing admission. As a result of a lowly ant that Charles Darwin was forced to make. He said, I must pass over this preliminary difficulty. And he did. He passed over it. Now he said, and I continue quoting, the great difficulty lies in the working ants differing widely from both the males and the fertile females in structures in the shape of the thorax and in being destitute of wings and sometimes in destitute of eyes and also of their instinct. He said, and I continue quoting, with the working ant, we have an insect differing greatly from its parents, yet absolutely sterile, so that it could never have transmitted successively acquired modifications of structure or instinct to its progeny. Then, he said in the book, which again I say is practically the Bible of the evolutionary world, the difficulty lies in understanding how such correlated modifications of structure could have been slowly accumulated by natural selection. And I continue quoting, but, he said, we have not as yet touched the acme of the difficulty. Look, he's had so many difficulties already, he said, I've got to pass over them. He said, they might appear to be actually fatal to the theory. He said, it may well be asked, how is it possible to reconcile this case with the theory of natural selection? He said this already. But he said he hasn't even got to the real acme of the difficulty yet. So let's get to the acme of it, the point of it, the real fulcrum of the problem. Namely, the fact that the neuters of several ants differ not only from the fertile males and females, but from each other, sometimes to an almost incredible degree. Well, there you have a part of the problem. It's only a part of it, as I've said, but it certainly is a part of the problem. They differ from their parents and from each other to an incredible degree, and yet they are produced by one fertile female. Now, maybe it sounds a little technical. Maybe it sounds a little difficult. It shouldn't be, because it's quite simple. Mr. Darwin admitted that the preliminary difficulty was simply passed over, and no wonder, because there was no other explanation possible. If you leave God out of the picture, and as the Bible said and predicted, they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, then what you've got to do is to exalt ignorance. And the way you exalt ignorance, well, in ancient times, you might have heard of the Gnostics. Now, Gnosticism, or being a Gnostic, meant knowledge. It meant having knowledge. It meant intelligence. It meant accumulation or collection of facts. Today, we have the school that is called agnosticism, or somebody saying virtually, hooray, I'm ignorant. I don't know a thing. I'm ignorant. That's what they seem to say today. And so they exalt ignorance by saying, we don't know. Well, you know, it's amazing to see the overwhelming confidence that evolutionists have in a theory where continually they are forced to admit they have no proof, that they're missing broad areas of proof. A lot of the laymen, I think, of this world assume that evolution is practically a complete chain, that is about 99, and as we would say, perhaps in the words of modern advertisement, 44 hundredths percent sure.
that it is missing only one little link of maybe one connection in this broad chain, and this is what average Mr. and Mrs. America, the average Mrs. Housewife, thinks about evolution. What she doesn't realize is they don't have a chain. They don't even have two links. They got one little crook of a piece, and it's not a link, it's a latch. Now, that's the fact. That's the way it really is. You want to hear one of the most embarrassing admissions ever made in the history of the evolutionary theory by Charles Darwin? Well, here it is. In looking at the slave-making properties of a certain kind of ant, at looking at the fact that one ant literally was willing to apparently exterminate itself for the good of another kind of ant, along with the admissions you've already seen and heard, here's what he said, and I'm going to quote his words slowly so you really get it. He said, "It will indeed be thought that I have an overweening confidence in the principle of natural selection when I do not admit that such wonderful and well-established facts at once annihilate the theory." End of quotation. I'm going to repeat that because that is incredible. And I agree with him. It will indeed be thought that, all right, because I do indeed think it. He said, and I quote again, "It will indeed be thought, in the light of all you've heard on this program, now that we've already quoted about these insects and that you can read in this article in the Plain Truth magazine," he said, and I quote, "It will indeed be thought that I have an overweening confidence in the principle of natural selection when I do not admit that such wonderful and well-established facts at once annihilate the theory." From Origin of Species, Charles Darwin, page 273. Oh, yes, my friends, it will indeed be thought that he had an overweening confidence in it, and I think that the majority of evolutionists have an overweening confidence in their theory when they will not admit that their theory has utterly been annihilated by the facts to the contrary. Continually, some of these evolutionists have to try to get rid of the facts about some of these creatures and their interrelationships, their interdependability. They laugh when you will say, "Which came first, the chicken or the egg?" You know why they laugh? Because it's the easiest way out. And because there is no answer, that's why they laugh. Well, I've got answers for you. And you can have them by getting a lot of this that I've given you today in print, in the Plain Truth magazine, and by writing for the booklets I've announced on the subject. Now, first of all, you need to get this full-color magazine, The Plain Truth. It is 52 pages, absolutely filled with pictures, some of them the most remarkable close-up color photography in our science lab that you have ever seen about some of these strange creatures. And in the current number, this article on Go to the Ant. You know that scientists for years thought Solomon was wrong? Oh, they always do if somebody in the Bible quotes something or says something. They thought that when Solomon said that ants actually gathered their food in the summer and stored it up for the winter, that this was utterly wrong. It couldn't be true. Well, it is true, and this article shows you it's true, and they've discovered there are harvesting ants, and that, too, is a great blow to the theory of evolution. So the article on the ants, every single number in the Plain Truth, articles on that subject. Then also, write for this booklet on Does God Exist? And the booklet entitled The Proof of the Bible. And coming along automatically with that will be the article on seven proofs God exists, going through these seven proofs that I've been discussing briefly on this broadcast. They're absolutely free of charge. There is no price for them. No one's going to call on you. There is no follow-up. Your name is carefully kept in our modern IBM files. It's not given to someone else. There is no bill to follow. If you write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. Remember the articles. The Plain Truth is absolutely free of charge. It's 52 pages, free of charge, no price. And so until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.